The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show, the home of geek, folklore and paranormal entertainment, with me, Charles Christian, as once again we delve into the worlds of weirdness, urban myths, history, geek culture, ghost magic, witchcraft, the occult, and anything else I think will intrigue you. This week we have another packed show and another intriguing interview for your delectation. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Flowers. Stephen received a PhD in medieval studies and Germanic languages from the University of Texas at Austin in 1984. His dissertation was entitled Runes and Magic, and since then he has written over 50 books, some of them under the pen name of Edred Thorson, on runes, Gothic culture, and other esoteric topics. Today, Dr. Flowers is considered the world's foremost authority on esoteric runology, and he is passionate about sharing his knowledge. He lives in the woods near Austin, Texas, with his wife Crystal and a menagerie of animal companions. Not surprisingly, we are talking about runes, from their origins as a writing system through to their revival in more recent times. Are runes merely an alternative alphabet, or does their symbolism provide a key to understanding older European cultures and their legends? Did the German Nazis hijack the legitimate use and study of runes? What are the Elder Furthark, and should we care? And what role do runes have in witchcraft and magic rituals? My great pleasure to be talking to our guest today, Dr. Stephen Flowers. Stephen, good to be talking to you.
Hello, how are you doing, everybody?
we're all doing fine, we hope. Now,
Yes.
I've been looking at your notes, and I've also been looking at your website, seekthemystery.com.
A note here, people should change that, and then But seekthemysteries.com is a better website. It's just been put up. It's seekthemysteries.com.
All right.
Plural. Okay.
All right. Yes, gotcha. I'm looking at the books that are listed up there, and one of the big ones flagged up there is the Revival of the Runes.
Yes.
The Modern Rediscovery and Reinvention of Germanic Runes. Now, to a lot of us in Europe, runes mean one of two things. Either it was a strange angular writing style used by Nordic peoples, typically the Vikings, during the Viking Age, which faded out, or it's associated with, I suppose, supernatural and ghost stories and the like. I'm thinking particularly of the M.R. Jane story, the casting of the runes.
Casting the runes.
Yeah. So what's your perspective on it? What's the modern rediscovery and reinvention? Tell us all about that.
Okay, well, runes, it's a writing system, that's true. It was probably invented by a single man around maybe as early as 200 B.C. and was inspired by the Latin alphabet. It seems to be the origin of it formal, in a formal sense. But instead of, as all peoples generally did, just adopting and adapting a model from the past, the Greek system, the Roman system, whatever, the Germanic peoples, and this individual moving forward, it reinvented the system, giving it a new order, giving it names to ascribing each one of the sounds and so forth. And so there was a whole lore attached to the runes from the beginning. The word rune means secret or mystery, not letter or shape or something like that. So the idea was that these embodied a codified system of their mysteries. So that's probably the origin of it, but it was used in practical sense of making very short inscriptions. For 1,000 years, these inscriptions were pretty short and succinct, and it never developed into a literary system such as the Roman or Greek alphabet did, because it was kept as a very restricted form of literacy. Even at the height of runic activity in Scandinavia, probably only 1-2% of people could read runes. It was sort of like a proprietary set of information that was kept to the rune masters, who typically dispensed this in a professional kind of guild system.
Right.
So for 1,000 years, it went on like that, in this kind of traditional indigenous lore of the Germanic peoples. There are no runic inscriptions until the Middle Ages, in which we find Latin language written in runes, but otherwise, its runes are exclusively used by Germanic peoples. Anglo-Saxons, there are 100 known runic inscriptions in the Anglo-Saxon system in England. There are then thousands of them in Scandinavia.
Yeah, yeah. A bit of background here. The Germanic people, now obviously we know the connection between the Anglo-Saxons and the Germanic people, but they were also the origins of the Scandinavian people as well, weren't they?
Right, right. If we read, it's all very, not much a matter of speculation. A Roman historian named Tacitus wrote a book which was put out in 97 AD called Germania. And in that, he describes, in a very short little book, under 100 pages, describes the Germanic peoples, and he describes their tribes and their mores and their culture and so forth as a kind of just an overview of these barbaric people that he sort of cast as a bunch of noble savages who embodied a lot of the virtues that he felt the Romans had lost at that time. And so it's somewhat romanticized, but archaeology has proven that most of his observations are corroborated. And these all these tribes became the Germans, the Scandinavians, and the Anglo-Saxons. The Anglo-Saxons, the Jute people that came over from northern Germany in around 450 AD and established England.
Yes, yes. Right. Are the Germanic people, I'm jumping about a bit here, but are the Germanic people the same as the Goths? Or are they...
The Goths, yes, they are, yes.
Yeah.
The Gothic people were from Sweden or the northern, the Baltic coast just across from Sweden, right in there. It's where they had their origin. And then they began to migrate down into what is present-day Russia, and they divided into two groups, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, and then they swept down through southern Europe, and, of course, famously, the Visigoths sacked Rome in 410 AD, moved into Spain, established a Visigothic Kingdom, and in Italy, the Ostrogoths under Theodoric the Great established the Kingdom of Italy, the first national entity of Italy after the fall of the empire, which was right precipitated, of course, by a lot of these invasions by the Goths. So, yes, the Goths are a Germanic people, but their language, East Germanic, has completely died out, has no living representatives today.
Yes.
The last ones passed out of history in the 1700s on the Crimean Peninsula.
Oh, right. They were there. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, this is one of the things that we don't realize today is that there were such huge population mass migrations during this period from the coming to the end of the Roman era through what we now sometimes inaccurately call the Dark Ages, where people would move thousands of miles
Yes, that's what happened. That's why they call it the Migration Age. And that's if we look at the personal names, typical personal names of Italians and Spanish people, or many of them are Gothic Germanic names, Alfredo, Federico, whatever. They lionized their past. Some honored it, such as these names, et cetera, and recognized it, and then others were horrified and jealous of the conquest of the empire by these Germanic peoples, and of course we have the name, the word vandalizing, destroying property, and so forth, based on one of these tribal names, the Vandals, who were in Spain and then actually ruled for 200 years in northern Africa as well, had a Visigothic, a Vandalic kingdom there in North Africa.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the more fascinating ones that end up moving across Europe and then becoming an outpost in what would nowadays be, what, Algeria and Morocco, that kind of area.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get back to runes. I'm just putting that bit of background in there. You're talking about the runic revival. So the last use of runes was presumably at a time when Christianity was established fully across Europe, and obviously...
Well, that, no, that I have to stop you there. That one of the great... We're one of the great misnomers or misunderstandings of the runes and runic history, and that's partly because we may talk about this later, about how the runes were sort of misused. And one of the ways is a very current way, and that is that it becomes so totally identified with paganism that then, because this did happen in Iceland and some places at some time, where runes were identified with paganism and therefore suppressed, but that was much later. Almost all of your English runic inscriptions that you'll see in the British Museum and elsewhere are Christian. I mean, the Christians embraced and used the runes, and most of these Scandinavian and Sweden inscriptions are ostensibly Christian. They invoke the Christian God and other things. It was not rejected. Christianity did not reject the runes initially. But then, because people used it and did identify with their country with these things, the church eventually turned its back on them and said, this is an indigenous thing, not international, not Latin-based, and so we have to suppress it. But that took centuries to come to that realization.
Right. So when did the use of runes die out?
Okay. Well, it never completely died out, but when you look at the situation where it was universally, almost all tribes, it was found everywhere, and then over time it was found in Scandinavia, and it sort of died out on the continent under Christian influence, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
But in Scandinavia, it was extremely, it was at its height of in the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. And then it died out. At first, it was reduced to a alphabetic system. That is, the runes were modified to line up with all of the Latin letters, and the old Futhark system of 24 and then 16 runes was virtually forgotten, not entirely, because we have poems that still refer back to this system, this old system. But it did virtually die out as a system of writing somewhere around 1500. Now, that was the time when interest, especially in Sweden and Denmark, among humanists, academics, people in the academic world, was peaked at about this time. And so they started to say, what, for example, the most famous an important reviver of the runes in Sweden in around 1600 was a man by the name of Johan Bure, or Johannes Bureus in his Latinized form. He lived in the area of Uppland, up there where around north of Stockholm, and he said, my God, they're all over the countryside. There are thousands of these stones with weird writing on them. We cannot understand them. And, of course, in a world dominated by biblical mythology, many people, most, thought these are antediluvian inscriptions done by giants, or perhaps by Adam and Eve themselves. That kind of weird superstition, you know, prevailed. But he said, well, no, I've got to find out what these things really say. So he said, well, I found that the farmers on Gotland, on the island of Gotland, and in the area of Dalarna, just north of where he was, were still writing in runes. They were writing on their tools or putting their names on things and things of that nature. So he inquired and found out what these letters actually were as far as their phonetic values are concerned. And he began and founded the modern system, or the modern school of runology, of studying them on an academic level. And however, it must also be pointed out that this man, Johan Bure, was also a Rosicrucian and a mystic and an alchemist.
Right.
And so from the beginning of the runic revival, academically, it was even at that time, again, reconnected to its roots of having something to do with the mysterious and the occult, if you will. And so that is a great deal of my book is devoted to the study of Johan Bure in this book we're talking about.
Right. Gotcha. From then onwards, what happens then?
Well, tradition of runic revival, and I try to trace this in the book carefully, begins to go in two different directions, sort of weaving its way back and forth between this just academic study of what do these letters, what are their values, what do they say, what is the language, how can we interpret and read these inscriptions, and how does it contribute to the history of language and so forth. It's just completely a sort of linguistic decoding of these inscriptions. But on the other hand, there were the constant draw of this mysterious, magical, mythic world, especially then also, of course, the literature of Iceland was being rediscovered at about that same time in the 1600s. Humanists went to Iceland from Denmark, which possessed Iceland at the time,
mm-hmm.
And began to collect all of these manuscripts they could find, which were thousands of them. And there in a sheep stall was found a codex called the Codex, eventually dubbed the Codex Regius, the Royal Codex. And in it, it contained the bulk of the mythic poetry that became known as the Edda.
Right.
And there we find, for example, the myth of how the origin of the runes and their connection to the god Odin, and how they were generated through an initiatory experience by this god named Odin.
Right.
Wodan. Yep, today's Wednesday, isn't it?
It is indeed Woden's Day. Yes.
Okay, Woden's Day. Okay,
yes.
So when people ask me about these old gods and say, that's ridiculous, I say, you still invoke them every week.
Yep.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Yep.
They're still here.
They are, yes. It's one of those strange days of the week in English and related languages are named after the Norse and Germanic gods.
But Odin was so dangerous, you see,
yes,
that, for example, in German, you go, Dienstag, that's related to, obscurely to Tyr, and Donnerstag, that's good, the Thor's day. But when we come to Wednesday, it's Mittwoch, midweek.
Right.
But they didn't want to say that name. That name was so taboo, so powerful that they didn't say it.
Yes.
So.
I like that. I like that.
But the English kept them all alive better than anyone, or as well as anyone.
Yeah. Now, you're talking about the runic revival, and we've got the rediscovery of the runes, and you're talking about them being associated with esoteric traditions. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
Well, as I said, the main thing when we discovered that there's a whole mythology related to the origin of them, connecting them to Odin, or beginning of writing, and his sort of answers to Mercury in the mythology. So these things were there from the beginning. Every time you see in this Edda where runes come up, 95% of the time, they're always connected with something magical, something esoteric, since it does mean mystery or secret. And the word itself, when we study it throughout Icelandic language, for example, can just as easily mean something mysterious or hidden, and doesn't always necessarily explicitly refer to runic characters, which are just part of this mysterious world, not its entirety or define it. And so that's been there from the beginning, and every time you see them in the actual old literature, old High German, old English, full of rune words that indicate this mysterious, magical sort of connection. And so that's always been there. And Johann Bure emphasized this himself. And then, like I said, the split came, and you see that there's sort of the way that intellectual life in general in the West went, whereby there's a separation of the secular from the sacred,
mm-hmm.
and this split occurs. And, of course, the Renaissance times still had that unity, a sense of unity of everything. And but the split comes, and so it takes two different directions. And so the esoteric side of things becomes increasingly esoteric and sort of magical, and sometimes goes off the rails as far as logic and reason are concerned, right? And on the other hand, the academic world becomes so stultified, so positivistic in its approach that it becomes sterile and meaningless. That's the fate of just life and philosophy and spiritual life in general since the Renaissance.
Yes, I mean, you see that with alchemy, don't you, that was once a respectable pursuit, and then sometime round about the end of the 17th century, it starts to split, and alchemist is not proper science anymore, and there's the proper scientists. I'm using the word proper with quotes round it in an ironic way.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got characters like Newton, who wrote masses about alchemy and alchemistic pursuits. So, you know, he's regarded as one of the sort of founders of modern science, but he has his feet firmly in the older alchemical tradition. And it's the same thing, isn't it, that, you know, it's not proper science anymore.
Right, right. There's no reason, you know, why one must reject one side of, if there are sides, one part of the endeavors of the human mind from another. They should ideally inform one another and make each other better.
Yeah, no, totally agree. What esoteric traditions are associated then with runes today?
Today? Well, beginning, of course, in about a century ago, German or actually Austrian poet and mystic and theosophist, really, wrote a book called The Secret of the Runes, Das Geheimnis der Runen. And he established a sort of a German language-based, esoteric school of interpretation for the runes. And this name was Guido von List. And from that point on in Germany, this became a, he wrote his first book, or was writing these kind of books from about 1904 to his death in 1919. And so he greatly influenced, on a popular level, a whole generation of German-speaking people. And this is the feature that is responsible for the popularity of runes, for example, during the time of the Third Reich.
Yes.
It was part of this whole movement, in especially in the German-speaking world, but elsewhere as well, that we refer to as the Reform Movement, the Reform of Life Movement, which involved nudism and back to nature and natural foods. And nature, the word nature and the word nation are etymologically related, so that people returning to nature also return to their indigenous roots, indigenous things. They admired other peoples of the world, whether the American Indian or the Polynesians, etc., who seemed to be close to nature. Tacitus, 2,000 years ago, was writing the same thing about the Germanic peoples, that they went around naked and they were like nature people. They were close to nature. And so this whole sort of trope of all of these things became very influential on the German people, and is responsible for the enormous popularity of runic, of Germanic symbols, style, aesthetics. The artist, we've all seen his work, we don't recognize his name, Meister Fidus. All the sort of hippie, the hippies discovered him later and made all these posters and everything based on his art. And yeah, that was sort of the spirit of the time. It wasn't anything political, particularly, or anything like that. But certainly the National Socialists used this as a branding mechanism for propagandistic purposes. And even though very much on the record that people like Hitler and so forth roundly rejected this whole notion of people dressing up like Vikings and being ridiculous, you know. It's silly. It ruins the whole thing for me, he said. You know, it's like incredibly stupid. But he tolerated it. And he used it, you know, and others used it because it was a branding mechanism. People talk about the occult power of the Nazis. Well, their occult power is the same one that's being used on us every day today. Everyone learned their lessons from them. And, you know, what we call branding and marketing and creation of logos and all of that kind of thing was mastered by them and proliferates to the day, to this day.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the secret, as it were, behind that association between Nazis and runes is a spurious one because, first of all, it was used, but just because you use a hammer doesn't mean, you know, that's your, defines you as a person. So, it was just useful to them. And, it was extremely popular, widespread. When we say widespread, honest and true scientists studying the whole time period say that probably around 10% of the population of Germany in 1933, let's say, could be identified as belonging to or being extremely sympathetic with these kind of New Age ideas of one kind or another. But in politics, 10%, you know, that's a part. That's a substantial piece of the puzzle when you're playing the game of democracy, even if you're just planning to put an end to it once you get it mastered, you know.
Yes.
But, you know, you got to get this. So that they, and even tyrannical systems do pay attention to the will of the people, you know.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they just, like, you know, Ceausescu or something like that, they could just be out there pontificating to the people, and then all of a sudden they just say, we're not taking it anymore.
Yeah.
We're coming for you, you know, and that can happen.
Yeah.
If they will, it's all a matter of will, determination and organization. Anything is possible.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Look at what's happening in Afghanistan, you know.
Yeah.
The crazy stuff.
You're listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian.
Post World War II, and obviously we then had a great outbreak of denazification where the winners of the war then proceeded to try and destroy and discredit all the Nazis' branding. Did runes go into a decline then? Because, you know, they were
absolutely
associated with...
Well, it's interesting from the standpoint of the sort of the occult world. What happened there is very... very transparent and obvious to look at, and that is that, yes, in the denazification, these symbols became tabooized. Today, generally in Germany, is anything runic. I have people wanting to interview me, but say, well, I don't want to really talk about runes, you know, because they're reticent to do so in German-speaking, whether Austria or Germany. So it's worse now, much worse, than it was in immediately after the war. You know, in the 50s and the 60s, runes were still pretty much okay, as long as you didn't connect them directly with National Socialist ideology, and you just said this is a system of magic. The German, he's a member of the Fraternita Saturni, Karl Spiesberger, wrote his books in the 50s, beginning in 1955, a book on rune magic and so forth, where he took the system of Guido von Liszt and others that had written in his wake and brought it into a more New Age kind of setting, although he quoted Guido von Liszt and cited all these older sources as his sources, but nevertheless, it was absolutely free of any political, racial, you know, baggage. You know, they got rid of that. And it, such as it was, people read Guido von Liszt and they think, oh, I've heard that he was like, the Nazis got ideas from him. And it's like, well, and then, but then I read his book, or in English, like some of the ones I've translated, and say, I didn't find anything like that in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not real. It's not there. You know, it was just used by others to those ends. But these people were no more or less oriented towards racial fanaticism, or you name it, than the average person of those countries in those times, our own. You know, I mean, in the United States, we, you know, well, Hitler, what did he have? He had on behind his desk in the Brown House, he had a big giant portrait of Henry Ford. It was from him that he got all of his ideas.
Yes.
In his the book, The Eternal Journey, he wanted to be just like Henry Ford. I'm going to invent a car, you know, like he did.
Yes.
And he did, and all that sort of thing. But the, that was from America that they got all of their ideas, not ideas per se, the root, but the policies and the details of things like eugenics and sterilization programs. Our great institutions here in America, Harvard, Yale, they had strict quotas on Jews. You can't have, you know, more than like 1 or 2% Jewish students in these institutions. We were practicing those things right up until, you know, we saw, well, this is where this kind of thinking ends, you know?
Yeah.
And so we thought better of it. But all of our country, we were all, so that to look back to the turn of the century, late 19th, early 20th century, and apply to people who lived in those times, the lessons that we have learned is just completely wrong-headed.
Yeah, yeah. It's the thing that constantly comes out with, well, things like the destruction of statues and things that because of their historical past. But the point is, when they were erected, they were the norm.
Here in this country, people don't realize this. I'm from, I mean, I don't have deep roots in the South because most of my ancestors came to this country after the Civil War. But in any event, in the South, what was happening was why they erected so many of these statues was an attempt to bind, as Lincoln said in one of his last speeches, bind the nation's wounds, you know, to sort of invite or say, yeah, it's okay. You know, we recognize, you know, your valor and whatever it is, you know, just sort of pet them, you know, nice, you know, we're it's okay.
Yeah.
To bind up the nation's wounds. That was part of why these statues were put up. Now there's a lot of bad stuff going on in that atmosphere also, but that was part of the motivation. Just like they're tearing down here Columbus statues because, oh, he was against, you know, the indigenous peoples. He was so mean and all that. But why are those Columbus statues up? Well, it was a way specifically to invite or to welcome in, after some tough times, Italian immigrants to the United States, which were huge in number, and they were having a rough time. So they make their hero and say, make him a national hero and make him a part of the whole. These are magical acts themselves, see? To include people. But these people who are always talking about inclusivity don't recognize the past efforts at inclusivity. And that's what Columbus statues or Robert E. Lee statues actually were.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, and now, you know, you put up a Martin Luther King statue, et cetera, all good, but having the same magical effect of having a symbol and creating a social myth or idea that includes people who had formerly been excluded. All that's good.
Mm-hmm.
you know. But it was always good. It was good in the past. It's good in the present. It's a good idea. But to say that an old good idea is now a bad idea.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of wrong.
It is, and you just know in 100 years' time, modern statues will be being torn down for the same reasons. There'll be a change.
Oh, yeah, well, you set that precedent, you know, then it's going to be a continuing pattern. And it's but that's where a lot of the things I'm interested in and writing about and so forth is trying to come to a more reasonable, balanced view of all of these things, so that if we understand what is actually going on, then it's harder to just have a knee-jerk reaction in this kind of group think. Oh, my friends all say it's bad, it's bad. Okay, it's bad, let's do something. You know?
Yeah.
And I haven't thought it through. Well, how did that happen? Why is it there? Is there anything good about it? Was there a good dimension to it? And so forth. And so that's the saddest thing about our whole world as it is right now is the descent into unreason.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, there are no two sides to an argument. There's only one side, and that's the right one, and anybody who doesn't agree with it is therefore the enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just the Middle Ages. It's returning to a medieval mindset.
Yeah.
That should have been shown by, but that's part of the pattern is to make people. What do you mean? A kid 16 years old is going to medieval. What does that mean? Is that like Lord of the Rings? Is that like, you know, Harry Potter or what? I don't know. You know, they're not really educated in the significance of all of this history. And so then, therefore, when you try to explain it, it's completely, they're just seeds falling on barren earth, as Jesus would have said, I guess, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's sad, and that's why I'm a teacher at heart, PhD, you know, but my world was not to be because the whole field in which I'm interested years ago already being just totally removed from the academic world. Anything before 1500, that's that date again, anything before 1500, European before 1500, get rid of it. No telling what people will think if they find out about this, you know? So I'm trying to teach regardless.
In terms of runes being used today, would I be right in thinking, apart from some academic research into it, it's mainly being used as a lettering system and linked with, you know, I see people talking about it with basically casting fortunes, you know, in a form of magical sense.
Yeah, right. Divination. Tacitus, again, our Roman guy from 2,000 years ago, describes in his book Germania how the Germanic peoples would cast pieces of wood inscribed with what he called in Latin noti, notes, notations, and they would cast it onto a white cloth, and he would pick up three of these and read, you know, the future or whatever, you know, fortune or whatever it was. Divination would be carried out with these three things. So we have descriptions of that from 2,000 years ago. So that's pretty solid evidence. But mainly runes, unfortunately, people don't study them at the level, on the academic level, the New Age type person, the occult type person, which I count myself in that. You know, it is not really well schooled in the languages and the writing, per se. Most of the time, runes are seen as, whether it's in the divinatory system or not, as individual, discrete kind of icons or symbols tied to their names, which are in the older Futhark, you have the first one is fehu, which means cattle or money or value, a unit of value, urus, which is the name of the aurochs, and so forth, referring back to very ancient values and symbols and life. And so these things are mainly seen by most people today, using it for magical spiritual purposes, as systems, mainly the 24-room Futhark, which came to an end around 750 A.D., and then it was transitioned into a 16-room Futhark, or the Anglo-Saxon Futhark, which had more runes, but also, again, they are seen by people studying them today on an esoteric level, mainly as individual characters, kind of like think of something like the Hebrew alphabet, which is one of the few other alphabets of the world, which the Semitic alphabet, older, generally had this feature, that each one of the letters had names also. Aleph being an ox, bet, a house, etc. Now, the Jewish people, the Hebrew, you almost see no speculation in Kabbalistic literature, esoteric Jewish literature, referring to the names on some esoteric level. And the reason for that is really they inherited that system from other Semitic peoples. It's not indigenous to them, per se. So they use numbers and number values in an extremely esoteric manner. Obviously, you know that. But that's similar in that way. But it's, see, that each individual character has an esoteric value, and people interact with that value on a kind of a discrete base. Now, in ancient times, runic times, inscriptions were written out. They were names, they were longer inscriptions, etc. And so they did write in. Now, people today, when they try to write in runes, it's almost always just a terrible mess, you know, because they try to write modern English in runes, which is very possible. There's systems for doing that. Our Anglo-Saxon runes, I mean, are much more precise in their reflection of English sounds than the Latin alphabet is. Look, you know, there are things like the N sound. We have to go to two Latin letters, N and G, to account for that, but there's a rune for that. Or the S sound, for in these, in the the thorn letter. We were, at one point, the Anglo-Saxons just said, well, there's no Latin letter for this, we're going to use a rune here. So they use the win, the W rune, and the thorn, the TH rune, in Anglo-Saxon manuscripts because they felt Latin doesn't cut it. But then eventually the runes were done away with in the English alphabet. But it was there at one point. And so it was. So these are very suited to writing English sounds.
Yeah.
But people are trying to write in runes today. It's just a terrible mess, I'm telling you. You know. So, and it can be, it should be done on an esoteric level, but it takes some study, you know, to get it right. But few people write things in runes. People will talk about rune scripts, where they put like three or four runes unrelated to one another, but just that's the three symbols I want to kind of put together in my meditation or my contemplation or my magic, and I'll just put those there, but they won't make up a word. But in olden times, that's what they did, you see. That was the poetic weaving of language and meaning and events of the world together into one sort of weave work. And so that was the way in which the magic worked in olden times. But that skill has been lost because it really requires one some deep study to get that correct.
Yeah.
So Biases, there are a lot of people that like to adopt Norse names, you know.
Yeah.
And they'll then try to write those, make those words in Icelandic or whatever. And again, almost always there's some kind of grammatical error in there, you know. Icelandic is not an easy language. So anyway, the idea is that these old systems are used today, or old symbols, I'll put it that way, are used today, but they're being used in new ways. Now, I'm not saying, oh my gosh, you're terrible and awful for doing that. No. I mean, things change. You know, things are adopted and adapted. That's just the way of the world, but it is something that could be better again. It could be better.
Yeah.
And so that's what I try to endeavor to contribute to making it better and to try to make it more integral. That's my the integral runology, something that brings together all of the elements and all of the facets and dimensions that belong to the tradition, excluding none, including all. And so what's happened in our academic world is that it's become so positivistic, materialistic, that linguistics are okay, you know, and studying sound changes and where an umlaut might appear in a runic inscription and write on that. But when you start talking about the mythology and the whole world that really is reflected in the old material, well, you know, that's all very speculative. And, you know, of course, that was the thing that fascinated people throughout time. We want meaning. You don't just want an illustration of a sound change from Old English to modern English, whatever, which you just is it's interesting for a linguist, but for no one else.
Yeah.
But myth is always meaningful to everyone, always. And this is the world that runes come from, and they exist in actuality. But that is being excluded from the academic study of them increasingly.
Yeah.
So the last generations have just died out of the old school of academic runologists. My teacher and mentor in Germany, Klaus Duwe, just died, and he was, you know, an elderly man, but he worked to the, as all good German academics do, worked to his last breath, you know, working on academic things. And he was a spiritual man, a Christian, but, you know, that's not what I'm talking about. Christian, pagan, all that kind of nonsense. But someone who understands the human spirit and its needs and its desires and its what's meaningful to people, you know. And that's what integral runology is about, that bringing all things together into the individual's experience of the mythic, and to bring everything to bear upon the questions, excluding nothing, including everything.
What about you, we're drawing to the end of the interview now, but what about you in your projects? What's next? I mean, I've been looking at your websites, and there's a huge number of books you've written. I'm guessing you're working on something at the moment.
Oh, yes. I'm always working on something. I have about 15 more books to write. I'm 68 years old. I'm going to try to get all of them done before the end. Again, like my mentors, work to the last breath.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm coming out with a book shortly this year about runes, runology, the kind of book that you could use to write a term paper in high school, you know, or at the university or whatever. I'll address all the issues, so many of them we talked about here, but it's called Runes and Runology. Kind of a basic book, and it won't cost, like, if you try to buy books on that kind of topic and generally from academics, they'll cost you $60, you know, 100 yeah. you know, dollars, something like that. And so that's one book, a Viking rune oracle book, which decodes and teaches people how to use the runes to actually read meaning out of old Norse poetry from the Hávamál, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's coming out shortly. A whole book on the reform movement, reform of life movement I talked about before.
Yeah.
A new book on Icelandic magic. They're just a bunch of things.
Stephen, it's been great talking to you. Thank you ever so much for your time. I will leave you to go back to writing your more of your books.
Okay. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
Hey, guys. News. The title is Shuckland, and it's a brand new book by Charles Christian. It takes you on a journey through the weird wonders and intriguing mysteries of the Waveney Valley. Explore with Charles the truth behind the notorious black shuck of the book's title. Be transported to a world of demonic entities, murderous earls, ley lines, witchcraft, paganism, and discover the facts behind the outrageous legends and folklore of this seemingly peaceful corner of England. Shuckland is a 200-page illustrated paperback available through bookshops and online via Amazon and Books Etc., as well as the Urban Fantasist website at www.urbanfantasist.com. Shuckland is priced at $12.95, and there's an ebook version available on Amazon, priced just £3.25. Shuckland, get yours today.
Once again, a big thank you to this week's guest, Dr. Stephen Flowers. You can find out everything you want to know about his books and work on his website, which is at seekthemysteries.com. Seek the Mysteries is, incidentally, a translation of the Icelandic motto, Rain till Runa. You learn something new every week on this show. As ever, we'll also have the link on the Urban Fantasies website and in the podcast and YouTube metadata. We plan to have Stephen Flowers back later this year to discuss The Left-Hand Path, all about forbidden practices and spiritual heresies. Now it just remains for me to say, this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more strange tales for strange times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon, which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com, and on Twitter at @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.